All right, so we are all set. Now, first, I'm just going to offer it out. Does anyone have an initial question that they would like to ask either the speakers or just folks who are calling in? I figure instead of me just hogging that first question, I would open it up. All right, I am going to start with the first question, and it's really, really basic. And it's really, what would be your recommendation, and this is to both of you, for a clinic that just wants to get started taking the beginning steps of putting together a vestibular rehab program? What would you recommend those first steps be?
Can everyone hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I think so.
Okay, wonderful. We just want to make sure our volume was okay. So the initial steps are you would want to identify interest either at your facility or from the community, and you would really need the support, we believe truly, that you need the support of possibly a good neurologist, a good ear, nose, and throat doctor, an audiologist, and the physical therapist slash occupational therapist to kind of really spearhead this team. You know, we definitely believe that working together in the collaborative effort is really helpful in starting this program. And when we started this program at Children's 8 years ago, we were lucky enough to have ENTs on board, and, you know, we have good referrals from neurology and sports medicine. So we started going out to the different departments and doing presentations to them saying, this is how we could help your population. So, for example, hematology, oncology, we went to them and said, this is how we could better help your patients and try to get them on board and find out what their needs were. We went to concussion clinic and said, what are your needs? Who are you seeing that's dizzy in your clinic? And once we had all that support on board, we felt really confident in starting up the clinic.
Great. Now, do you have recommendations? Let's say, you all have some really nice, great equipment going in there. What would be your recommendation if, say, someone couldn't have all that expensive equipment to start with? What kind of tools could they use? Or is it really best to just try to get some of that more sophisticated equipment?
I tried to go through that a little bit during the presentation last week, things, at least how you could kind of screen for these ahead of time for different things. So, like, with the from a balance standpoint, you know, we use the Neurocom Balance Master and everything, but, again, not every clinic, especially starting up, is going to have that. So, you know, I'll do, like, a modified CAT-SIB or, you know, something along those lines to really, get a feel for that balance in with the sensory conflict condition, because that's really what you're looking at in order to isolate that vestibular balance control. Jennifer Braswell Christie actually wrote a really nice article in Pediatric Physical Therapy, I believe it was last spring or summer, on the most specific and sensitive tests for vestibular and balance testing in, I believe it's in children with sensorineural hearing loss is the population that she used, but it was either the spring or summer edition of last year, and she went through several, including the modified CAT-SIB. So that's a good place to start from a balance perspective. In order to do the dynamic visual acuity side of things, if you don't have the the DVA equipment, then I think going and using the eye chart, go ahead and have them move their, get their static visual acuity first. What line can they read to lowest first? Then go ahead and move their heads at the speed that we need them to move, and then have them continue to read the lines that they can. And we're looking for them, and then note where they can, the lowest lines that they can read accurately. And then any more than a two-line difference, then that's, an abnormal dynamic visual acuity screen, and you can start working on those adaptation or gaze stabilization exercises in order to improve upon that. So those are both, objective, tests and measures that you can use and continue to retest to see how, how the interventions are helping with that.
And from the audiology perspective, though, unfortunately, we just don't have great ways. Gretchen's testing functional balance, and we're testing more like anatomy and physiology. So I feel like we unfortunately, as audiologists, really need some of the specialized testing equipment.
All right, great, thanks.
Hi, this is Long Clark from Mount Washington Pediatric Hospital. I just had a quick question about some of the assessment tools. Have you guys ever looked into the NIH toolbox and looked at some of their vestibular testing that they, if for those facilities that do not have access to the high-tech equipment like the Neurocom or the BirdTech, have you ever looked into those and decided whether or not they would be pertinent to clinics that don't have access to that state-of-the-art equipment?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I have looked at that. It's been a while since I have, but I do think they do have some good options there, and especially with the dynamic visual acuity, I think there's a good option in there with the head tracker that they're using, and just using being able to use a laptop in order to look at the change in optotype in their visual acuity with and without head turns. So I do think that that's definitely a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
I know Rosemary Ryan spearheaded that, and she is excellent and well-renowned in the pediatric vestibular world and everything. So I definitely think that that would be worth a while if you're looking at starting that up and trying to get your hands on that as well. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? I have a question, and I believe you touched on it in the presentation, and it's more related to dizziness, comfort level. How do you monitor for that, and are there any precautions or contraindications to doing this type of therapy?
I think From a precaution standpoint, being able to test the vertebral artery and making sure that there's no adverse signs with that, because that's if you're testing Dick's Hall Pike, you're could potentially be with that position testing the vertebral artery in a way. And so before I do the Dick's Hall Pike, I do like to do the vertebral artery test in order to make sure that there's no adverse reaction there. So I think that's the biggest thing if you're going to be testing Dick's Hall Pike from a precaution standpoint. Obviously, if they've got any cervical issues as well, you want to take note of that as a precaution, because we are doing a lot of head turns and, again, the Dick's Hall Pike, moving them into those more extreme ranges of motion and whatnot. So you just want to check for any cervical precautions as well.
And let me just elaborate on the question. I think also you might be asking, if the patient is really, really dizzy and they're nauseous, at what point is it safe to continue with your eval, or what point mm-hmm. is it okay? How far can you push a patient that's not feeling good?
Mm-hmm. And definitely that comes with time. I try to, I definitely use the motion sensitivity test and in order to elicit what position changes or changes in head or body position are eliciting their symptoms. I always start off kind of middle of the road with those position changes. If I try and go with something that's extremely provoking for them to start off with habituation right off the bat with that, then it's going to make them feel awful and they're never going to come back and see me again. If I go too easy, maybe with something that just, that's a 1 out of 5 and it just lasts for 10 seconds, then I have them do habituation with that. They may not see as much of a benefit and a change. So when it comes to dizziness, I start middle of the road, and if it's, and then work our way, through the different position changes from there. If there's really only just one position that gets them, then we take it gradually, and just maybe not go into the extreme posture right away, but just kind of work toward it and building up their tolerance for that. So I always let them know that, the exercises that we're going to do are going to make you dizzy. We've already established that. We know that this posture, this change in body or head position makes you dizzy, but we're retraining your brain to not get dizzy with that position change anymore, and so that's why habituation is so so important.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Cindy from IPRC. I had a question for you regarding your frequency and duration. So how often do you typically see your clients, for how long, and how quickly do you usually see results?
That depends. So let me go with the frequency standpoint first. I would say for my typical middle-of-the-road vestibular rehab patient, I typically see them one time every other week. So we're seeing them once, every 2 weeks or so. And that's really because a lot of what I'm doing with habituation and the VOR and everything is dependent on, them doing their home program really consistently on a daily basis. And I've found that, that's been a good model for us here at Children's in order to really see those changes. And it allows them to, especially with the habituation standpoint, to have the amount of time to make those changes, so that by the time we follow up in 2 weeks, we can pick different position changes for the habituation. Same with the VOR. Like I said, we're changing kind of one thing at a time, whether it's the background distraction or the distance away and stuff like that. And so it's just a good amount of time for that retraining, and then so that we can progress the home program at the following session. So I would say frequency-wise, it's typically every other week. I would say I will, if it's a concussion patient that's really involved, really, really symptomatic, I'll bump them up to weekly, and then reduce as necessary, as needed. For the actual duration, I would say my peripheral kids move along a lot quicker. The central kids, maybe due to migraine or something along those lines, tend to move a little bit slower, so I typically see them for a longer duration or time period, if you will. It definitely depends on how consistent they are with their home program and their motivation. I do find, though, out of all, all the different populations I treat, this vestibular population is definitely motivated. They do not like to feel dizzy, and so they're really, consistent with home programming for the most part. So I would say, maybe 4 months, anywhere between 2 and 6 months. It just depends on the severity of their symptoms and what we're trying to get back to, are we just building from where we are? Are we trying to return back to, playing volleyball? What are we doing? So.
Do you see any kiddos in the inpatient setting?
We do not. Not at this time.
Okay. Hi, my name's Megan. I'm from Primary Children's Rehab, and I had a quick question. I wasn't with you for the initial presentation. I apologize about that. But I had a question about your experience with the population for younger kiddos, like under 5, and what standardized tests you use for them. Because right now we're coordinating with the adult side, and they do our older kiddos, and then we do the younger kiddos under 5. I've used the Peabody and the Brunix to do them. But I just didn't know your experience, especially with the cochlear implant population when they're getting them so young, if you had any experience with that.
I've used both of those as well. I think you're able, with the different subtests of each, you're able to kind of at least elicit and get a feel for how their balance system is working at the time. The kids with the cochlear implants definitely do a lot worse on those eyes closed conditions. So I take that into account, knowing that I may not expect them to go quite, make as much of an improvement in the balance subtest. But I have used both of those, and I do use both of those for the kids under 5 from a functional standpoint.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sure.
How young have you treated someone with vestibular issues?
How young?
This is Anne from HSC.
Sure. I'm sorry, was the question how young?
Yes.
Yes. I see infants for vestibular rehab who have already been identified with sensorineural hearing loss. And I tried to show in some of the videos last week too. Again, I think, kind of getting a feel for their equilibrium with static positions, looking at their head writing and trunk writing, kind of gives an idea of where their vestibular system is. And it may be that I'm just kind of seeing the kids that are really more involved from a hearing loss standpoint, because sometimes they can be super subtle, and it's not that they're really delayed or anything like that, but I do see infants, you know, that have already been identified with that sensorineural hearing loss that are not progressing with sitting balance and those types of things.
Sorry, this is Megan again. Thanks. From Primaries. Sorry to just elaborate on the cochlear implant and the really infant young kiddos. You know, we're trying to decide, just kind of wondering if it's beneficial for PTs to kind of assess pre and post cochlear implants, if there's any balance changes with that. Is that something that you guys do like as a standard, or is it something that you've tried in the past? Just because we're trying to work with the audiologist to see our role in helping them maybe when to – how to help those kiddos that are pre and post.
Hi, this is Violette. So right now we don't have a standard of practice where we're seeing kids pre and post implantation. There's certainly a lot of research to support why we would need to be doing pre and post implant, but unfortunately, you know, our ENTs right now, they're typically doing a lot of simultaneous implants anyway. So, you know, a few years ago when they were doing single-sided implants, it was more helpful to figure out what side they wanted to do it on. But now that they're simultaneously implanting, then, you know, they don't really care. They're going to implant. Just because the scores are so much better for kids hearing-wise and language-wise. So I guess to answer your question, we're doing more post-implantation, you know, once the kids are out further and they're having more trouble. And, you know, I was just saying to Gretchen today, pretty much if I see a child, and I'm an audiologist, if I see a child who has hypotonia in their chart and they have hearing loss, I'm already starting to think, like, is it actually hypotonia, or is there actually a vestibular dysfunction going on?
Cool.
So it's something we're definitely thinking about. Actually, today we have a little one coming, so with cochlear implantation. It definitely makes your vowel a lot trickier depending on their language level, but
yes.
Yeah, but we are doing it, and especially a little.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, because maybe I just need to go with, you know, chatting with the audiologist to maybe on the pre-side screening for those kind of balance issues before cochlear implantation to see if there's anything we can do even before surgery. So, yeah, I appreciate that so much.
Sure.
Thanks.
Any other questions? I have one just related to, you had mentioned in the presentation active versus passive head movement. Passive, an example would be just putting someone on a swing. Can you give examples of when you would use active versus passive as far as in your treatment?
Yeah, I prefer to use active range of motion at any time. I'd say really the only time I use passive is for the really young kids, infants and stuff like that don't or if a kid is so cognitively, you know, involved that they don't understand the cues that I'm telling them to, you know, to move their head and whatnot. So at any time I can do active, I will, and utilize passive if it's more of a cognitive, you know, issue, or those, you know, an infant that's just not going to understand, you know, your cues and stuff like that. So it's really the only time I use passive.
Thank you.
This is Cindy from IPRC. Can you give a little bit of your catchphrases or how you explain vestibular imbalance disorders to parents?
Well, from my end, I'll start with my end on audiology. A lot of times, it's not even on their radar, and when they Google after they get the initial diagnosis of hearing loss, it's not even on their radar. So they'll go and they'll Google sensory neural hearing loss, and rarely does vestibular disorders ever even pop up, and that's really sad. It's just one of those things that it's a new topic. It's something that we're catching more often now, and really only in the last maybe 5 years has this topic ever even exploded kind of on the forefront of our brains when we're thinking about hearing loss. So a lot of times we'll tell the parents, we show them a picture of the inner ear, and we'll say to them, hey, this little part over here is responsible for hearing, but there's a whole other half to the inner ear, and these semicircular canals on this end, that's for your child's balance. And sure enough, you wouldn't even believe it. I've been seeing kids for years, and all of a sudden the parent will say things to me like, well, you know what? She never did learn how to ride a bike without training wheels. And all of these things come to mind all of a sudden. You know, she never learned how to roller skate. And, you know, she was always the klutziest kid out there in ballet. So all of these things come up after we start to tell the parents. So that just tells us that our line of questioning as professionals, we're not capturing what these parents are actually experiencing at home. So just because these kids learn to walk and talk and run, a lot of times the parents think their vestibular system or their balance system is just fine. So a lot of times I'll tell the parents, no, your vestibular system is responsible for even higher level things, such as riding the bike or roller skating or ice skating or doing those fun things that make them kids. And then a lot of the parents will say, okay, well, we'd like to have the balance testing done. For some of my teenagers that I see in clinic that do not have hearing loss, they're there from, like, migraine symptoms or those kids, often we explain to them that you're going to have some testing done, and we're going to try to separate out whether or not your inner ear is responsible for your dizziness or your brain is causing you to have this dizziness. So we try to tell them, you know, in layman's terms like that, that that's what the testing is there for. Do you want to add to that, Gretchen?
No, I think that's perfect. You know, just, again, the, you know, trying to, it's hard for them to kind of, and I always kind of tell them, too, like, what balance is, because I say there's three things responsible for our balance. You know, we use our feet to feel the floor, we use our eyes to scan the environment, and we use our inner ear organs. And all those things have to sync up really nicely in the brain in order for us to balance. And so if we're more dependent on one, and then we find ourselves in a situation where we can't use that as well, like we're super dependent on somatosensory input, and then we're walking on a, you know, on a really uneven surface, then we have to really, you know, have inner ears and vision kick in order to help us balance more. And I think that, you know, that kind of helps from understanding the balance part of things. It's not just balance. There's individual pieces to it. For the habituation side of things, when I tell them, you know, I'm going to have you practice these positions over and over and over again until you're not dizzy anymore, basically, you know, from a timeline standpoint, they look at me like I'm crazy, and I tell them, I like to think of it like a figure skater. They spin and spin and spin and spin, and they don't get dizzy. And the reason they don't get dizzy is because they've done that move a million times every day for however, you know, as much time as they have. So that they've retrained their brain not to get dizzy with spinning. And I think that kind of helps click with families, too, as to the reasoning behind habituation.
Does anyone have any other questions? Are there any protocols for vestibular treatment out there that really anyone is aware of?
For treatment, no, not that I've seen.
Okay.
I think it's getting much more prevalent, though. I mean, vestibular is really exploding, so I wouldn't be surprised if there are things that come out, you know, down the line. So.
Great. Any other questions while we have Gretchen and Violette?
During the webinar, this is Cindy from IPRC. During the webinar, we talked a little bit about sort of the vestibular team. And who else do you work closely with besides the PT and the audiologist on your team?
Ear, nose, and throat doctors. Those are the three of us meet every once a month, so we meet every month. We also work closely, you know, sometimes we're communicating with the neurologist and the sports medicine doctors as well.
Yep. So if you were referred a patient that you suspected had really vestibular issues and they were not already seeing an ENT, would you refer them first?
Well, it depends. So that's the tricky part, that people use the word vestibular, and that's a blanket term, and that's what we're here for. So we're here to siphon out if it's, and that's, I really think, the audiologist's role in a lot of ways. Is it vestibular, we're talking peripheral, meaning inner ear vestibular, or is it vestibular, meaning central vestibular system involvement? So really the ENTs only need to get involved if we're suspecting that it's a peripheral or inner ear vestibular involvement. So it's really tricky because, you know, we worked with OTs in the past, and OTs I know have a test where they'll come up with a vestibular dysfunction. And we were getting these kids in there, and what we were finding out is that these kids actually did not have a dysfunction. So even though the testing came up when they did their, you know, behavioral questionnaires and whatnot as a vestibular dysfunction, these kids actually had very, very robust vestibular systems when we were testing their inner ears. Their inner ears were off the chart doing well. It was just rather a brain issue in how it was getting integrated. So I really feel like in the future, you know, just using the term vestibular, we're going to be changing our lingo on how we approach this vestibular topic. But for the purpose of me and T, we really are looking only at the kids who get confirmed with an inner ear issue in most cases. Good question.
Hi, and this is Megan from Primary.
Do you ever have any reimbursement issues?
Sorry.
Do you ever have any reimbursement issues with either DVAL or treatment? Insurance pretty much accepts, you know, what you're documenting, what you're doing.
Yeah, for the most part, for audiology, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have not had any issues with reimbursement. I just document, you know, the diagnosis, whether it's dizziness, balance problems, you know, whatever it may be. If we're working on the VOR and stuff, that's, you know, I bill for therapeutic activity. If we're focusing more on balance, I will do neuro re-ed. It just kind of depends on what the purpose of each exercise that we're doing is. So I have not had any difficulties with that. At least not that the business side is, you know, our department has told me.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Megan from Primaries. I had a quick question. You mentioned the ENT and when to refer. I work with a lot of OTs, and we're kind of trying to make a protocol for vestibular out here. And we're you know, struggling between delineating, you know, an OT's perspective of sensory integrative issues for vestibular, and then the PT as far as vestibular dysfunction as well. You touched on it briefly, as there is it kind of a difference as far as like the sensory component of it with kiddos that seek out vestibular input, and as far as sensory modulation. Do you have any more insight on how to delineate the two as far as when to make even a referral for OT and PT for vestibular concerns?
Good question. I'll start a little bit, and I'll have Gretchen pop in too. You know, we say in audiology, if you truly are a bilateral peripheral vestibular weakness, like you have no inner ear function on either side, you don't feel any movement. So these are not the kids that are going to tell you they get sick in a car. These are not the kids that get sick on rides, because they can go on a roller coaster all day and they're never going to feel the effects of the roller coaster. So right away, if a kid is telling you something like they're getting motion sickness, usually that is not an inner ear issue. Secondly, inner ear issues and central issues can say vertigo. So, you know, it's just a rule of thumb, the way that they've always taught us in grad school, is that if somebody tells you on July the 14th, I was minding my own business and all of a sudden I got the spins. I was twirling around. It lasted for an hour. I got better over time, but I'm so scared it's going to happen to me again. If they can be super specific about an event that they had, that's usually a peripheral lesion. Okay, that's usually like an inner ear inflammation that they got and they immediately had a reaction. If they're more vague about it, for example, we get a lot of kids who are on the, you know, depressive side, and so they'll have more central issues, so more chemical changes in their brain. A lot of times they'll say, I have been dizzy for 3 months. Can you remember the first day it happened? No, I feel like it's always been there. I probably can think back to when I was 2, and I also had issues too. So it's funny what they'll tell you. They're very vague, but it's been lasting forever, and it never goes away. Those kids are typically more central. I mean, just as a rule of thumb, just to kind of help you, you know, figure out who fits in the peripheral and who hits in the central. Obviously, if you've got a hearing loss tacked onto it, they're probably more on the peripheral side too. Do you have any? Are those helpful? Like ways to figure out if, Gretchen, you want to?
Yes, no, it really is. I appreciate that, because we were trying to talk it with the OTs, and a lot of times too, you know, the peripheral and central really helps. And what we've been kind of doing is like, how is it impacting, if it's impacting balance, gross motor skills, kind of more mobility, gait, things like that, then we kind of, the PTs take over with that. So we've been kind of using that as a rule of thumb, but this peripheral and central is really helpful as well. Okay. I appreciate it.
Yeah, a lot of, I feel like a lot of the vestibular seekers, you know, kids mm-hmm. who are seeking out, those seem to be more the sensory.
Yeah, the processing side of things than true, there's something wrong with my inner ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree, and I appreciate because sometimes it's hard to delineate because we have kids that, you know, have the hearing loss, and then they have also OT needs, and they also have PT needs. So it's, sometimes it's this big circle of a lot of different components. So, but, you know, some of the vestibular PT techniques can also help those kiddos too, even if they are seeing by OT as well. So, yeah, those questions are awesome, though. The vague and specific really are helpful.
Good. And we had a girl today who's a peripheral, and she said to me, I've had 3 episodes since July or whatever, and she can tell you the dates that the episodes happened on.
Any more questions for Violette or Gretchen or for anybody? I think this has been a pretty good discussion, and I would like to thank Violette and Gretchen so much for making themselves available a second time, so thank you. I also just want to give some updates as far as what's coming down the pike, and Cindy, just correct me if I'm wrong, but I think our next webinar will be Thursday, October 1st.
You are right.
The topic is Stanley Advisory Council, so stay tuned for that. And we are hoping for a network call on the Thursday after that on October 8th, and that, again, will be at 12 noon. So if there are no other questions or comments, I think we can close today's discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.